Imagine you're driving your car, right? And the check engine light flips on.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah, exactly. So you take it to the mechanic, and instead of actually opening the hood, he just takes a piece of black tape and sticks it right over the light on your
This
dashboard.
completely ignores the engine.
Right. He just pats the hood and says, there you go. You don't have to look at it anymore. And you drive off, but the engine is still struggling. It's still sputtering, still quietly tearing itself apart. Now imagine you've been driving that exact same car for 40 years.
I mean, that sounds completely insane.
It does. But if that sounds insane to you listening right now, then you're actually starting to understand the current state of psychiatric pharmacology.
It's a brutal analogy, I have to say, but honestly, it paints a very, very accurate picture of how we've been treating depression for decades. I mean, we've basically been managing the light on the dashboard, not the engine.
Which is exactly why today's deep dive feels so urgent. We're looking at a massive, comprehensive April 2026 article from the OOTW Journal. It's titled "Psilocybin and Depression: What Phase 3 Clinical Trials Actually Show."
A huge piece of research.
Yeah, and our mission for you joining us today is really simple. We are completely ignoring the cultural baggage. We're tossing out all the psychedelic hype. We're just going to look at the hard, peer-reviewed clinical data.
Right, because we really are at a point where the most rigorously controlled trials in the history of psychiatry are showing us what actually happens when you finally take that tape off the dashboard.
So to really wrap our heads around the magnitude of these new trials, we kind of have to talk about the scale of the failure we're currently living with, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is hard to overstate the rut we've been in. Globally, we're looking at a burden of 280 million people living with depression.
280 million. That's wild.
It is. And just in the US, in 2024 alone, 21 million adults experience a major depressive episode. And yet, for roughly 40 years, the primary medical response hasn't fundamentally changed at all.
We're talking about SSRIs and SNRIs here, right? Like the classic antidepressants.
Exactly, the standard toolkit. I mean, ever since fluoxetine, which most people know as Prozac, hit the market back in 1987, the gold standard has been drugs that block the reuptake of serotonin, or, serotonin and norepinephrine.
Right, keeping those chemicals floating around in the brain.
Mechanistically, yeah, they keep more of those chemicals in the synaptic gaps. But the catch is they take 4 to 6 weeks to even start showing a clinical effect.
And the source material highlights this thing called the STARD trial, which reading about this was a huge wake-up call for me.
Oh, yeah.
It
Start
was
with it.
the largest antidepressant effectiveness study ever conducted, and the results are honestly just pretty bleak.
They really are. The STARD trial is essentially the ultimate reality check for modern psychiatry. It showed that when you give a patient their very first antidepressant, only 37% achieve remission.
Wait, only 37%.
Yeah. Let that sink in. More than 6 out of 10 people do not get well on their first try. And even if you put a patient through 4 sequential trials over an entire year, like switching drugs, bumping up dosages, adding secondary medications to try and boost the effects,
Hearing everything.
right, that cumulative remission rate still only hits 67%.
Which leaves a massive chunk of people still suffering. And I guess that leads us to a term that comes up a lot in this research, which is treatment-resistant depression, or TRD.
Yeah, TRD is a very specific clinical definition. It basically means a patient has failed to respond to at least 2 adequate antidepressant trials of different pharmacological classes, taken at therapeutic doses, for at least 6 weeks each.
Okay, so they've really given it a fair shot.
Exactly. And globally, there are roughly 100 million people who fall into this category. And the stakes for this group are just incredibly high. I mean, they face significantly higher rates of hospitalization, functional impairment, and suicide risk compared to almost any other group in psychiatry.
Well, wait, I actually need to push back on a phrase you just used because it caught my eye in the source too.
Oh, sure.
You said adequate response. When I dug into how these trials measure that, I was totally stunned. In these studies, an adequate response just means a 50% reduction in symptoms on a rating scale.
Right.
So wait, a treatment could be declared a success in a clinical trial, but the patient is still walking around carrying half of their depression.
Yes. That distinction is so crucial for people to understand. In the world of clinical trials, a response just means you are significantly less depressed than you were. Like, you're feeling better, but you're absolutely not well.
You're just less bad.
Exactly. Remission is the actual goal. Remission means your score drops so low on that validated scale that you are essentially symptom-free. So when we look back at our current standard of care failing, a massive percentage of people, we're saying those medications aren't even getting them to that halfway point of a simple response.
Wow. Okay, so we have 100 million people whose engines are actively failing. So let's look at the data stepping into this massive void. The article breaks down two landmark trials that are completely upending the field, starting with the COMPASS Pathways Phase 2b trial.
Yeah, this was a real watershed moment. Until very recently, this was the largest randomized controlled double-blind psilocybin trial ever conducted. It was ultimately published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
A huge deal.
Massive. They enrolled 233 patients with severe treatment-resistant depression across 22 sites in 10 different countries.
I want to clarify something for you listening, though, because my mind initially pictured someone like eating a bag of mushrooms in a clinical setting.
Right, the classic gimmick.
Yeah, but that's not what's happening here at all. They use something called KEYCO-MP360.
Far from it, yeah. KEYMP360 is a synthetic GMP-certified psilocybin.
Meaning what, exactly?
Well, GMP stands for Good Manufacturing Practice, which means this is a highly controlled pharmaceutical-grade compound. It has absolute purity and exact microgram-level dosing. There's no biological variability like you'd find in an organic metrum.
Okay, got it.
So the researchers divided these 233 patients into three groups, and they gave each group a single dose. Just one dose. One group got a 1 milligram dose, which basically acts as an active placebo.
Right.
Another group got 10 milligrams, and the final group got a high dose of 25 milligrams.
And the week three results are where this huge paradigm shift starts to show up. The 25 milligram group showed a 12-point mean reduction on the clinical depression scale compared to just 7.9 for the 1 milligram placebo group.
Yeah.
But the actual remission numbers, where people are effectively symptom-free, that's what really stands out to me.
Oh, completely. Nearly a third of this high-dose group, 29.1%, achieved full remission. Compare that to just 7.6% in the 1 milligram group.
Wow.
And you really have to remember the context here. These are patients who had already failed multiple conventional treatments. And this wasn't just a fleeting high either. 12 weeks out from that single dose, 24.1% of the high-dose group still had a sustained clinical response.
That's incredible. But let's address the safety profile, too, because there is obviously a lot of hesitation and fear around psychedelics, which is totally understandable.
Sure.
The source noted the side effects were mostly transient, like headaches, some nausea, dizziness. But it did highlight that 7 participants in the high-dose group experienced suicidal ideation.
Right. And the investigators were very, very careful in analyzing that signal.
Mm-hmm.
What they found is that this rate of suicidal ideation actually matches the baseline rates you see in the treatment-resistant depression population anyway.
Oh, I see. So it's not necessarily the drug causing it.
Exactly. It seems to reflect the severity of the underlying illness rather than a specific side effect triggered by the psilocybin. But, you know, it serves as a stark reminder of how vulnerable this population is and why the ongoing phase 3 trials require such intensive, continuous monitoring.
Yeah, that makes sense. I actually want to circle back to a weird detail in that trial setup, though. The 10 milligram dose.
Yes, the middle group.
Right. According to the data, it didn't show statistically significant improvement compared to the 1 milligram placebo. So why is it this all or nothing switch? Is 10 milligrams just this biological no man's land where it's not strong enough to fix the engine, but you're still feeling the effects of the drug? Like, why does 25 milligrams suddenly cross this magic threshold?
It's fascinating.
Right.
It could completely challenge the standard pharmacological model. Usually you expect a linear dose response curve.
Right, like take a little more drug, get a little more effect.
Exactly.
Nah.
But psilocybin seems to operate on a neurobiological threshold.
Hmm.
10 milligrams might, you know, stir the waters and create some perceptual changes, but it doesn't cross the specific activation threshold needed to trigger a massive reorganization of the brain's networks.
So you just don't get the reset.
Right.
Right.
You really need that 25 milligram hammer to effectively shatter the rigid thought patterns of a severely depressed brain.
Which brings us perfectly to the second major study in the article, the Johns Hopkins trial.
Yes. So the Johns Hopkins researchers looked at a different population, major depressive disorder. So these are folks who haven't necessarily failed multiple other treatments yet.
Right.
It was a smaller, highly focused study of 24 adults, and they were given 2 doses spaced 4 weeks apart.
And the numbers they pulled from this are just, they're difficult to wrap your head around. A 71% response rate at week 4, 54% full remission,
Yeah.
and 75% of those people maintained the positive effects 3 months later without taking any more medication.
It's unprecedented. To truly understand how unusual those numbers are, scientists use a statistical metric called Cohen's d. It measures the effect size of a treatment. So basically, how much of a difference the drug makes compared to a placebo.
Okay.
If you look at a typical daily SSRI, the effect size usually hovers around 0.3 to 0.5.
Okay, so what does a 0.3 actually feel like to a patient?
Think of it like trying to notice a temperature drop in a room. A 0.3 is like the temperature dropping by half a degree. You might feel a tiny bit cooler, but it's subtle, and there's a lot of overlap with how you felt before.
Okay, I get that.
The Johns Hopkins trial produced an effect size of 2.5.
Wait, 2.5.
Right, a 2.5 is like walking out of a sauna into a blizzard. The difference is not subtle at all. The two states are almost entirely distinct. It's the largest effect size ever recorded in any antidepressant clinical trial in history.
That is just mind-blowing. Okay, so the standalone numbers are massive. But what happens when you put psilocybin directly in the ring with our current gold standard? Because the article mentions Robin Carhart-Harris ran a trial at Imperial College London in 2021 doing exactly that.
He did. He took 59 patients with TRD and set up a true head-to-head trial. One group got two sessions of psilocybin. The other group was put on a 6-week daily regimen of a very common standard SSRI called escitalopram.
And reading the results of this trial honestly gave me mental whiplash. It creates this fascinating paradox.
Oh, clearly.
On the primary depression scale they used, at the 6-week mark, the psilocybin group's score dropped by 8 points. The SSRI group's score dropped by 6 points. So, I mean, psilocybin did slightly better, but mathematically, that 2-point difference didn't reach statistical significance.
Right. If you stop reading the paper right there, you'd walk away thinking, well, psilocybin isn't meaningfully better than the pills we already prescribed.
Yeah.
But the real story, the plot twist, is actually buried in the secondary outcomes.
Yes, the Oxford Depression Questionnaire.
Exactly. The researchers didn't just measure sadness, they measured the texture of the patient's emotional lives. Things like emotional blunting, a sense of connectedness, and finding meaning in life.
Which are so important.
Absolutely. And the data show the SSRI group suffered significant emotional blunting. They felt numb. And this is a very common, known pharmacological effect of standard antidepressants.
It's the black tape over the check engine light.
Exactly. You don't see the blinding, terrifying warning light of your depression anymore, but you also can't see the speedometer or the fuel gauge. The SSRIs broadly dampen the entire serotonergic system. You avoid the crushing lows, sure, but you sacrifice the highs. You sacrifice joy and spontaneity.
Wow.
The psilocybin group, conversely, showed zero emotional blunting. None. And beyond just not being numb, they vastly outperformed the SSRI group in metrics of psychological flexibility, feeling deeply connected to other people, and reporting a renewed meaning in life.
This poses such a profound philosophical challenge for you listening. Just think about this. If a patient feels more connected to their family and they actually find meaning in their daily life again, but the primary clinical questionnaire says there's no statistical difference between the two drugs,
Right.
is the drug failing or is our entire framework for measuring depression fundamentally broken?
That debate is actively tearing through the psychiatric community right now. Carhart-Harris summed it up beautifully, I think. He observed that psilocybin is lifting the lid on suppressed emotional processing. The clinical scales we've relied on for 40 years were explicitly built to measure the dampening of symptoms. They literally just measure how well the tape hides the light.
Yeah.
They simply weren't designed to quantify an expansion of emotional flexibility or the restoration of human connection.
So let's look at the engine then. What does lifting the lid actually look like under the hood? If we aren't just broadly dampening the brain's chemical system, what is physically happening inside the brain to make this expansion possible?
Well, the mechanism of action is completely different. Standard SSRIs work proximally. They block the serotonin transporter, sort of like plugging the drain in a sink, so the ambient serotonin just pools up between the cells.
Okay, I can picture that.
Psilocybin completely bypasses that drain. It acts as a direct agonist, essentially turning on a specific faucet called the 5-HT2A receptor. And these receptors are densely clustered in the prefrontal cortex, which governs our highest order thinking.
And the source material highlights that hitting that 5-HT2A receptor triggers three distinct massive changes. The first one is default mode network suppression.
Yes. The default mode network, or DMN, is basically the brain's rumination center. It manages your autobiographical memory, your sense of self, and your self-referential thinking.
Okay.
In a depressed brain, the DMN is incredibly hyperactive. It's like a skipping record, constantly replaying negative loops and worst-case scenarios.
It sounds exhausting.
It is. But fMRI scans, which map real-time blood flow in the brain, show that psilocybin rapidly and dramatically suppresses this network.
Which completely explains that subjective feeling people report of ego dissolution. The rigid, punishing voice in your head just temporarily shuts off.
Exactly. The rigid self quiets down, creating space.
Then we have the second change, which the article calls BDNF upregulation, or Miracle-Grow for the brain.
It's a fantastic descriptor. BDNF stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Chronic depression is highly associated with chronically low levels of BDNF, particularly in the hippocampus, which handles memory and emotional regulation.
Right.
The brain literally struggles to maintain healthy connections. But within 24 hours of a single psilocybin dose, BDNF levels just surge. It physically opens a critical window of intense neuroplasticity, where the brain can literally sprout new structural branches and form new synaptic connections at an accelerated rate.
Which sets up the third change, network entropy. The resting state fMRI scans show that the brain's normal isolated networks temporarily break down, resulting in this massive explosion of cross-network communication.
Yep.
Parts of the brain that haven't spoken to each other in years suddenly start exchanging information.
Right. The rigid attractors of depression, those deep frozen grooves of negative thought you get trapped in, are completely disrupted and replaced by highly flexible, fluid neural dynamics.
I was trying to picture all three of these mechanisms working together, and it sounds exactly like shaking a snow globe.
Oh, I like that.
Like when someone has TRD, it's like all the snow is clumped into these rigid, frozen, immovable piles at the bottom of the globe. The DMN is stuck, and then psilocybin comes in and violently shakes the globe, throwing every single snowflake up into the air.
Yeah.
That's the entropy. And when the snow finally starts to settle, it doesn't land in the same frozen clumps. The landscape at the bottom is entirely new, soft, and flexible.
It's a brilliant analogy. And honestly, the most important part of that image is what happens after the shake.
Right.
Once the snow settles into that new landscape, the brain isn't dependent on a daily pill to hold it there. The structural change has already happened.
But the shake is really only step one, right? Because what happens while the snow is falling in the days immediately following the session is actually what determines if the patient stays well long term.
Yes, absolutely. That brings us to what clinicians call the integration window. Remember that BDNF surge, the Miracle-Grow?
Yeah.
It keeps the brain in a state of heightened neuroplasticity for roughly 48 to 72 hours after the session. The brain is incredibly malleable, exceptionally receptive to new learning and emotional processing.
So you don't just take the dose, go home, watch TV, and wake up cured.
Far from it. If you don't intentionally shape that new neural landscape, the snow might just drift right back into those old depressed piles. This window requires active psychological support, reflective therapy, somatic work, and even physical nutritional support.
Which is really interesting. The source actually mentions a specific nutritional approach used during this window, the OTW cacao stack.
Right.
It uses theobromine and mild MAO inhibitors. And for you listening, an MAO inhibitor essentially slows down the enzymes in your body that break down these crucial compounds.
Exactly.
So by using the stack, they're chemically extending that neuroplastic window, keeping the scaffolding up a little longer while the new structural cement dries.
It's all about providing the right environment, both chemically and psychologically, to make the new connections stick.
Which brings me to a terrifying logistical hurdle. If this therapy requires highly trained therapists, integration sessions, and a 6 to 8 hour dosing day, how does this ever scale?
It's tough.
We're looking at the FDA phase 3 pathway right now, aiming for approval sometime between 2027 and 2029. They're testing over 500 participants across 40 sites. And the FDA is demanding mandatory therapist training as a strict condition of use.
Yeah, it's an entirely new regulatory paradigm for the FDA. They are evaluating a pharmaceutical chemical, sure, but it has a mandatory human delivery system attached to it. The drug and the therapy are completely inseparable.
But mathematically, think about the 100 million people with treatment-resistant depression. If every single one of them needs 8 hours in a room with two highly trained therapists, that's over a billion therapist hours. Yep. Are we staring at a miraculous cure that only a tiny fraction of wealthy or lucky people will ever actually access?
That is the central haunting challenge facing phase 3 and the commercial rollout.
Mm-hmm.
The scientific question, does this work, has largely been answered with a resounding yes. The logistical question, how do we get it to the people who need it without breaking the healthcare system, is incredibly daunting.
Well, what about the other rapid-acting alternatives we have right now, like ketamine or Spravato?
So esketamine is currently FDA approved and widely available for TRD in clinics right now.
Right.
And it does act rapidly, often relieving suicidal ideation within hours.
Okay, that's good.
But mechanistically, it's very different. Ketamine is an NMDA receptor antagonist, not a 5-HT2A agonist. It creates a temporary dissociative state and an immediate chemical shift, but the duration of the effect is significantly shorter.
Ah, I see.
It doesn't trigger that same profound structural neuroplastic rewiring. As a result, patients typically require repeated, ongoing infusions to maintain the benefit.
So you're tethered to the clinic. It keeps coming back to this fundamental shift the source is pointing toward. We are moving away from a 40-year-old model of daily symptom management, dampening the system, slapping tape over the check engine light, and moving toward a model of targeted single-episode neuroplastic resets.
Exactly. The entire field is pivoting from a philosophy of suppression to a philosophy of expansion.
And the numbers back up the pivot. I mean, a 71% response rate for major depression in the Hopkins trial, an unprecedented effect size of 2.5. These aren't just incremental improvements. These are paradigm-shattering metrics that redefine what's possible in psychiatric medicine.
Truly. And as we look at the bigger picture, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
If a compound like psilocybin works not by blunting our sadness, but by increasing our psychological flexibility and restoring our connection to meaning, it begs a massive question. For 40 years, have we been treating depression as a purely chemical imbalance that just needs to be neutralized? What if it's actually a crisis of rigid neural connectivity that desperately needs to be liberated? If the future of medicine is about expanding consciousness rather than suppressing symptoms, how will that fundamentally change the way we view mental health itself?
That is such a profound question to walk away with. It really forces you to wonder what happens when we finally take the tape off the dashboard, pop the hood, and actually fix the engine. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking those big questions, keep exploring the sources, and we'll catch you next time.